Good evening, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. Tonight, we will be replaying an episode that features the vinyl record Private Parts by Robert Ashley. So please wiggle those fingers and toes to the soothing sounds of Robert Ashley.
Aloha, and welcome to this special edition of The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio.
Much aloha from sunny Los Angeles, California. Hi there.
Much aloha.
Hi again. How's everybody doing?
The reason why this is a special episode, the reason why it is so special, is because after this episode, Nicholas and I are taking a well-deserved summer break.
Yes, very well-deserved, because even though LA is sunny, Steve needs a tan.
That's right. I put on some shorts the other day, and when I went out, I felt like I had crawled out from under a rock or something. I looked like a some kind of worm or mole that lives underground and never comes up to the surface. So, thankfully, this is our last episode of the summer. We have our bags packed, and no matter how much we would like to work through the summer, the union rules actually have it so that we aren't allowed.
We thought that since there wasn't going to be another show until the fall, that we would make this episode as special as possible. Steve, why don't you tell the good people how special it is?
Yeah, well, how special can it be? Well, instead of having someone come in to the studio and talk to you, as we have been doing, our guest today is not even a person. Our guest today is an object. The object is a record. This is a record. And we are going to play both sides of this one record to you. But it's not just playing a record to play a record. Of all the things we've shown you, of all the people you've met throughout this last season, and of all our guests we've actually had in the studio, this record is a very special record. I'd say that without this record, there wouldn't even be a talking show on K-Chung Radio. I'd be bolder and I'd say that without this record, neither Nicholas or I would be doing a talking show on any radio station anywhere on Earth. Am I right, Nicholas?
Steve, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here looking at this thing, thinking, what could be more pertinent to what we are doing than this thing we have before us?
Right. I love it when you say that. So, what record could we be talking about? What record could so move two people as to motivate them to give up a sizable chunk of each of their weeks to the pursuit of talking?
It's not that dramatic, Steve, but what we can say is it's probably not piano playing. A great mystery in itself.
I think we should maybe even say it together. The record we're talking about is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Robert Ashley's Private Parts.
The record.
Yes.
I think maybe we should just play the record, both sides. And Nicholas and I will rejoin you later and we'll talk a bit more about this record. And hopefully that will explain a bit more about this radio show in general. If you're just joining us now, remember you can always go back and check out the archives or hold tight and listen to reruns that K-Chung will be airing while we're on break. And you can see how all this has unfolded from this point here, how all this has unfolded to this point here. And if you're a long time listener, I'm sure you feel like you are owed a serious explanation. So hopefully some of that will become clearer with today's episode. Anyway, here you go. The greatest mystery of them all. Enjoy.
He took himself seriously. Motel rooms had lost their punch for him. He opened all his bags. There were two, and inside those two, there were two more. It's not an easy situation. But there was something like abandon in the air. There was something like the feeling of the idea of silk scarves in the air. There was a kind of madness to it, the kind we read about in magazines. One of the bags contained a bottle of liquor, a sure sign of thoughtfulness about who one might have been. He poured himself a small drink in a fluted plastic glass sans ice. He thought to himself, if I were from the big town, I would be calm and debonair. The big town doesn't send its riffraff out. He sat on the bed, both feet on the floor. He studied the ashtray and tried to rule out preference, preferring over not preferring. But he preferred gravity over what other state, preferring in that case earth, the earth as they say, preferring some state over non-state. Now he grips himself with determination, even knowing that it causes sadness. He is determined to be what? He is determined to be serious. He had determined once to be serious. Later he knew that he had made a mistake, but too late he had arrived and there were rooms and all rooms were not the same, some better than others, he thought. A better view, a better layout, better shower, softer bed, not so far from noise, more like home, etc., etc. Very abstract. He lifted the telephone from its cradle. His determination got stronger, if no clearer, even as he fainted in its force. Were it not for our momentum, the inertia of our actions, the constant inspiration of our habits, we could not continue. The will is almost nothing, he thought to himself. At the sound of the first ring, he hung up. He pushed down the button and listened to the silence of the object in his hand, and then he hung up. Very dramatic. The phone rang immediately. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. He brings this cloud of conditions with him. He He is at the center of a ball of hot stuff that we haven't put our minds to yet. And sitting on the bed in the motel room is no different. Somewhere in another room in range, somebody got it and phoned him. It happens all the time. Really. A kind of restlessness in that range. He sat and thought about obedience. He had resolved that of the two kinds, the kind that takes every message of order, rule, law, as error, that everybody who passes along these messages, that loathes the buildings, that contradicts the inner voice, that resists, in short, was his, and that the other kind, how could it be? He wasn't happy with the world. He worked with the forwardness and the backwardness. He worked with what things are ahead of us and with what things are behind us. I guess the other kind would be to work with things that are alongside, the attachments. Obedience was impossible for him. At the same time, he was cooperative and indeed solicitous. No one in the world would have mistaken him for a real person. Obedience, etc. The other kind works with the things that are of the alongside us, the attachments. At the same time, he was cooperative. The numbers on the telephone, the parts of the book, the notes of the scale, they are the same, are they not? They come from the sameness of the idea of the outsideness, not the alongside the outsideness, the differentness. It was a problem, being cooperative and at the same time refusing obedience and carrying the load of the idea of differentness. He wants. He handles himself in the morning. It's just like for every other man. The fantasy is the distance, the reluctance, the reticence, the otherness. The fantasy is the uncleanness. So getting up gets to be a problem for a sensitive person like him. The problem is to run that gauntlet again. Remove problem. Remove gauntlet. Remove run. Remove is to. Remove the. Remove that. Leave this. Make this whatever. He lights the motel room with a slightly blue body light. When he is alone, he forgets sometimes to walk. He just moves. Sometimes they touch, sometimes they don't, and everything in between. As sometimes he forgets to combine talk with thinking, and just thinks, or just talks. Especially, I think, it happens in those rooms. Who knows why? The way it disconnects from what's just outside is predictable, is it not so? It never stops being a mystery. We have talked about it. When he says hello, you hear a long whining sound, which is his voice and the hello. It is as different from whatever, the way one might remember, as a sound a cat would make. He is not unusual in this, I think. He is absolutely uninhabitable. a thankless star. Remove star, remove thankless, remove A. Replace with, he has a special way of speaking, but it seems only to make him more like other men. This is one place, and here every kid is armed. So where you going? Hunting. Only sometimes we don't see the guns. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The town and always references to down and up. Down from Des Moines, up from somewhere. Missed my chance, didn't even see it. Thought it was a threat to house and home. Why don't you come up to the big town? No thanks. Looking back, didn't get the up and down part. How could I have missed it? Get a grip on yourself, he said. Working against time was another thing, he said. Here I am working against time. The pencil fairly flew as he made out his simple requests for breakfast. Room service, courtesy of the company. This is a record. I am sitting on a bench next to myself. Inside of me, the words form. Come down out of the tree and fight like a man. Two G's and eggs. This is not a record. This is a story. I want to say something about myself. I am not sitting on a bench next to myself, whatever that means. I am a city of habits. I am completely knowable in every way. I recognize superstition in every form. The anger of the words wakes me in the dream of myself. I imagine there are two men on the bench. The exchange between them will not be seen. They will not put it forth to be seen. And if I make something of the situation to show a difference between the two men, the difference will distract the true onlooker. But the film fogs, you know. 1G and fogs. And add a dish of prunes if they are in season. The men are in the park in the small Midwestern town. That is, the bench is in the park. We know from what is past that the men are on the bench. They are old by doctor's standards. The park graces the courthouse of the county. The courthouse has about it the simple air of failure, an abandoned outpost. The park has sidewalks, fences, trees, grass, and a statue of a man and a horse at war. Or ready for war. They are alone with their intentions. The sculptor has made the horse look stupid. The man's jaw is firm. The time is late morning and early summer. The sun shines. In this scene, there are two shots. The park and all its details, frozen, broken on the right edge, sometimes up to two-thirds across the frame by the body of a person, very close, blurred, moving almost rhythmically. We have just begun and already we are stuck. working against time, as they say. The camera is obsessed with what it sees. The park. The ragged edge. Nothing moves. Except the edge. The edge moves. It's as if there is no other place. His mind races. 1G in fogs. 2Gs in eggs. When the two men spoke, they spoke about permanence and impermanence. They noted that there were certain things which were impermanent, and other things to which the term impermanence did not apply. Thus they came to make a great division between that which is impermanent and that which is permanent. Everything in this transitory category turned out to be the particulars of our existence, and these were divided into physical, mental, and others which were neither physical nor mental. Among those particulars which were neither physical nor mental, they listed attainment, aging, and coincidence. On the permanent side of this great division of reality was a notion they referred to as space. And by that term, they meant neither conceptual space nor space as given by our senses. They meant connections. They decided that such space is irreducible and not transitory, and that it exists as long as one is alive. They wondered, naturally, what becomes of it. This impasse is no help at all. Consider his situation. For instance, he is expected to be positive and helpful about breakfast. In the order of things, it is more important that she know about the prunes than that the shot should change. And what about the problems we have seen in him? He is still sitting on the bed, both feet on the floor. The small drink in the fluted plastic glass sans ice is hardly touched. The phone has just stopped ringing. In his mind, the two men are frozen on the bench. The horse looks stupid. The warrior's jaw is firm. Incredibly slowly, our view begins to slide. His idea is that death always takes one by surprise. Always. There is no way to prepare. He imagines absolute awareness on the other side. He wonders, as we all do, how it comes to you that you are dead. We were distracted by the fluid right edge. There is an absoluteness to surprise, he thinks. He applies this simple thought to the problem of how to move the shot. Incredibly slowly, our view begins to slide, but begins as a problem. We are enchanted by the park and all its details, frozen, broken on the right edge by the body of the person very close, blurred, moving rhythmically. How can it begin to change? How can the beginning go unnoticed? How can we pass from one state to another? Is it possible, if one already has a certain experience of life, to start directly on the path? Or is there danger involved in trying to do advanced practices without having the proper foundation? they came to believe that unless one has actually gone through the preliminary experiences, conclusions may be drawn on the basis of insufficient information, and that these conclusions may produce just the opposite effect of the one which is intended. In other words, one never knows. And so the view begins to slide anyway, as they say, sliding eastward, turning eastward, the particulars moving left to right across the frame, a parade of sorts, and it comes to rest finally on the road, the street that holds the park. We are still obsessed. We are not relieved. This view is no different. How could it be? Except that we have moved off the body of the person, very close and blurred, and every edge is raw. And there is some machine approaching, wider than it is high, as they say. A pack of motorcycles, a herd of elephants, a tribe of Bedouins, something from the east, barely moving in a cloud of haze and heat and dust, in utmost telephoto, cold and green and flat. The idea of the slit, the eye of the needle. She makes a double life. She makes two from one and one. She makes a perfect system every day. She makes it work. She stands there in the doorway of her mother's house, looking at the grass and sky and at where they meet. Never once thinking thoughts like, it's so like a line, or the difference is so powerful, or which way shall I take to leave? My mind turns to my breath, one. My mind watches my breath, two. My mind turns and watches my breath. Three. My mind turns and faces my breath. Four. My mind faces my breath. Five. My mind studies my breath. Six. My mind sees every aspect of the beauty of my breath. Seven. My mind watches my breath soothing itself. Eight. My mind sees every part of my breath. Nine. My breath is not indifferent to itself. again. She never thinks of possibility or of how probable it is that they have come together. Those thoughts never enter her mind. Nor do thoughts of sports. She has no desire to improve her muscles. For her, piano playing is the only mystery. It's so beautiful, and how they do it, no one knows. She gets catalogs of every sort in the mail. Everything imaginable is pictured. She finds her way among the pictures without hesitation. She is not afraid of happiness. She is entirely without shame. The numbers are made of rubber or something like that. They stretch. They never lose their shape. They are ageless. They don't need repair. They need attention and respect. She thinks about two things that I know of. One is elevation, and that comes clothed in light, so to speak. She loathes the dark. She sleeps in light. She likes highness. 4,128 feet here. 4,218 feet there. And the body of the house itself. $14.28 here. $48.12 there. The other is proportions. Coincidence isn't a mystery to her. The margin is always wide enough. 42 or 40 with 20 is always 62 or 60. And I mean 42 with 20 can be 60 as well as 62. And the other way around. Just as 10 and 20 can be 32 or 30. Or 12 and 20 can be 30. She stands there in the doorway of her mother's house and thinks these thoughts. That $14.28 is more attractive than $14 because of the 28. No one likes or dislikes zeros. And that 42 or 40 is fixed in some way. She thinks about her father's age. She does the calculation one more time. She remembers 62. Thirty and some number is 62. And that number with 10 is 42. She remembers 42. Remembers is the wrong word. She dwells on 42. She turns and faces it. She watches. She studies it. It is the key. the mystery of the balances is there. The Masonic secret lies there. The church forbids its angels entry there. The gypsies camp there. Blood is exchanged there. Mothers weep there. It is night there. 30 and some number is 62. And that number with 10 is 42. That number translates now to then. That number is the answer in the way that numbers answer. That simple notion, a coincidence among coincidences, is all one needs to know. My mind turns to my breath. My mind watches my breath. My mind turns and watches my breath. My mind turns and faces my breath. My mind faces my breath. My mind studies my breath. My mind sees every aspect of the beauty of my breath. My mind watches my breath soothing itself. My mind sees every part of my breath. My breath is not indifferent to itself. She waked at 10. She remembers 10. She left the dark at 10. She waked in light. So 42 or 40 or 44 is fixed. 14.28 is more attractive than $14. It's just that way. The firmness of it is a consolation. Three men have loved her. One a decade on the average. Uncertainties are wrong. In this scene, there is one shot. Giordano Bruno comes to mind, whoever he is. She is in the doorway of her mother's house. She faces south. We see it two ways. First is the house behind her and the great northern constellations. She looks away from difference and discrepancy. Magnetic north, true north, the North Star path. It's too like the calculation. Except that 10 and 42 are fixed together. We are looking west. She is on the right edge of the shop. She is Earth. We are the sun. People are gathered in the backyard. This is the celebration of the changing of the light. They do it as often as they can in summer. They come to talk. they pass the time. They soothe their thoughts with lemonade. They say things like, she never had a stitch that she could call her own, poor thing. And Carl's still president over at the bank, ain't he? And now if I was doing it, and she didn't cook much, never really had the time, you know. And I wouldn't say that, not at all. They are the planets in the scheme of things. Giordano Bruno shot. The problem is the arc. The changing angle of the shot. It defies geometry. The drawings of a geocentric solar system, when we meet them in the books, make us avert our eyes. Heresy is heresy. We make one great weird curve from the east edge of the backyard, looking west. She is on the right edge of the shot, across, following the equator of the backyard, to the west edge, looking east. Now she is on the left edge. At some point, midway, we face, both looking at the center. The center is between us, except that for the purpose of the shot, or in the interests of economy, she doesn't move. She is standing in the doorway of her mother's house, the doorway to the back porch. The backyard is the south. Behind her, the great northern constellation rises in the majesty of its architecture. Well, maybe that's a little too much. Let's just say that contradictions are behind her and in the backyard. God, this set of circumstances that is indescribable with our geometry. A picnic of sorts. A celebration of the changing of the light. And we glide through that chaos, facing her, watching her, studying her. Not circling her, remember. Circling, but not circling her. She is circling. We are circling. Now she is on the left edge. Caught still in her accounting of those three decades silently. She is so beautiful. A pre-industrial equation. God, this is sentimental. This is the hour of the mystery of the barn swallows. One, where do they go in daytime? Two, do they never rest? Three, when you buy them in the store, made in China, on the end of strings, they do exactly what they do alive. Four, how is that possible? The idea of the changing center is not in anything we make. Our toys run down. On the other hand, of course, the Chinese are said to not take pictures. At least not of the outside. Six of one, two times three of one, five plus one of one, nine minus three of one, half a dozen of another. It would be perfect if, as we made the great curve through the heavens of the backyard, providentially or accidentally, depending on your point of view, each of the planets would move exactly in the path and at the speed and with the purpose of the expression of the other idea. Maybe that's too much to wish. Giordano Bruno. I think they burned him. He was too positive. Fight fire with fire. In this shot, he is wrong about the larger order, whatever that means. There is just the sun and earth and some center that they share. All other facts in this heaven. One has climbed a tree. Two are eating watermelon. One always says it's getting late. One succeeded at the plant. One works at the bank. The specialists. They are just straight lines seen wrong. Sundown, one. The time it disappears. Gloaming, two. The twilight, dusk. Crepuscle, the twilight, three, the half-light. Twilight, four, pale purplish blue to pale violet, lighter than dusk blue. Civil twilight, until the sun is up to 6 degrees below horizon. Enough light on clear days for ordinary occupations. Nautical twilight, until the sun is up to 12 degrees below horizon. astronomical twilight, until the sun is 18 degrees down, more or less. Clair de lune, 5, greener and paler than dusk. Dusk, 6, redder and darker than clair de lune. Dear George, what's going on? I'm not the same person that I used to be.
Wow. I remember first hearing this record and struggling to understand what it was that I found so appealing about it. What its charm actually was. I can still remember the initial experience, despite not being able to understand that experience very well. The ingredients, as you heard, are simple. A man talking and some light music underneath. But for some reason, it's gone on to power almost every aspect of my creative life. And it's so different from other records that are similar in that nature, like Jim Backus's Delicious, for example. Anyway, I'm sure that this work is familiar to many of you. But for people who aren't so familiar, and maybe you're having a similar first-time encounter experience like the one Nicholas and I had many years ago, maybe some of this will shed some light on what just happened. Maybe you're just feeling totally blown away right now, like we did feel. I think at the time that I first discovered Robert Ashley, I was struggling with the inherent abstraction of music. It's hard for music to tell you anything. It just happens. And at the same time, telling people something isn't really the best kind of thing to do. I mean, who says that you know so much about what's going on anyway, right? There are, let's be honest, also very easy ways to tell people things. So why would you bother trying to jam it into some music or jam it into a painting or whatever? You could just tell someone something if you actually know that thing that you're claiming to tell people, right? Anyway, and so I was finding it hard to communicate the things I was interested in through doing music. And even doing pop music with lyrics and everything, you still end up basically running up against a kind of slogan level of thinking. And if you wanted to do more with people, it just seemed really difficult. At the same time, there was this other thing, this evil mountain of spoken word and things like slam poetry and suspiciously corporate things like motivational speaking. And they all had about them this sort of toxic stench of sort of 90s aspirational identity politics, that kind of thing. These things seem to be too much, to be too terrible. And you can't just tell people things that way either. I mean, if you tell people things as a motivational speaker, they're suspicious. If you tell people things as a slam poet, they're dismissive. It's, and rightly so in all those cases. So I think what's weird is that somehow this record put those problems behind me. The music on this record is so fully abstract that it could be anything, or at least that's how it felt to me. It's hardly even a thing at all. At the same time, the speaking is equally vague. Like, what is he actually telling us? What is this? Can you honestly tell me what the subject of that talking we just heard was? On the one hand, there is this very New Agey character to the whole thing, and it sounds like the script of a meditation tape or something. And the tablet doesn't help, right? And yet, here we have things about kids with guns, and there's this sinister photographic element that is watching things and yet somehow unable to make them any clearer or to bring them into any sort of focus, is unable to make them any easier to see. There's so much stuff in there.
I can't agree with you more, Steve. I mean, this thing, this Robert Ashley recording, it levels me every time I hear it. And just like you, Steve Cato, I couldn't wrap my head around it for years. I mean, I've been listening to this thing for a long time. It's been confusing the entire time. But now that it has been years, I'm slowly starting to understand what I do like about it. There was something back then for me in the character of music in general that was so very confusing. Something I wanted to try and hear through in order to understand what was going on, find something structural inside it or something. And the only conclusion I've come to is that you can't really do that. That sounds in themselves are sloppy communicators, and they have difficulty saying things. And it seems like the place where sound and meaning kind of meet head on is in the voice, which is what makes Robert Ashley so interesting to me. He's coming at the voice in this way that is so casual, but so kind of meaningful, because we never really hear each other's voices. We are too busy searching for the meaning, you know, the language within the voice. But with Bob Ashley, his hypnotic talking kind of entangles the meaning within itself in such a way that this struggle between listening to the voice and hearing the story in the opera is right in your face the whole time, staring at you.
Yeah, that's amazing, Nick. And I have to say that I agree. And to take your observation farther, I think it's worth noting that as much as the sounds themselves are sloppy communicators, and this is just as important to the record we just heard, I think, the written language, the actual text, isn't much better. What precision it gains through sort of its linguistic connectedness to the rest of our language, it loses again through context, placement, and weirdly enough, through the texture of the voice.
Yeah, I've got to point out that even though he is singing, he's also just talking. He's just blabbering on about half pints, buddy. And I guess in the end, what's so special is that his talking is music, but really only in as much as it's not.
Yeah. I think it's key to mention, too, that I came to this recording just as a recording. I had no context for understanding what the recording was, except that I knew that Robert Ashley was a contemporary composer who issued most of his recordings on Lovely Music. Was that the same for you, Nick?
Sort of. I mean, my story is similar, but different. My first musical experiences were late at night, sitting at the family computer after my dad had gone to bed, and just downloading tons of MP3s off of Soulseek. And every night I was downloading the stuff and listening to it during the day and getting hungrier and hungrier and for stranger and weirder exotic sounds. Anything that would push my understanding of what music was and could be. And it was a really strange sort of consumption, especially since I didn't start playing music until much later. And I can't even remember how I came across Ashley's recordings, but they lingered there for a while, and I was listening to everything I could find of his. And just like you, Steve, it was really confusing.
Yeah, really confused. And so while we've been talking about the apparent opacity of this thing, of this work, by this point we've done a great deal of research into the thing as well. I mean, this has been years of interest on both of our parts, and we've learned an awful lot about this piece, and that it's not, and the things we've learned rather are not at all clear from listening to it. And that's added a bit of clarity, and it's actually added so much to my admiration of Robert Ashley. But I feel that that extra knowledge hasn't touched this recording, not even a little bit. For example, did you know that when what we just heard were parts 1 and 7 of an opera, and that the opera is basically structured as a kind of dueling solo between Ashley's talking and Blue Jean Tierney's piano? I mean, I, for one, never even imagined considering something like this an opera. And so, in a way, the audacity of that gesture was satisfyingly provocative to me. I think it also helped me to, I think, be freer with the large forms of culture that I would have had than I would have had been in the past. And while what we've just heard has been an apparent excerpt from a larger work, I don't think at any point I've ever felt that the record we just heard was in any way incomplete.
Yeah, but in the end, I don't get it.
It's weird.
Yeah. It doesn't... That work has never made sense to me in the way that Newton's laws do. And maybe what's been so liberating about it is that it always reminds me that these things of culture that we have don't have to make sense. We don't have to get them. They have the ability to resist all that kind of stuff. And that in the end, things like ice cream cones and operas are sometimes different. But that's a whole nother story. So thanks everyone for listening to the last episode of this summer of The Talking Show. And go out there and enjoy the beach, because we sure will. Goodbye.